Music composed by Philip Glass for the classic silent film Dracula. Chances are someone dressed like a vampire will ring your doorbell this Halloween. Pretty good. He might be in the company of a witch, a ghost, or other spooky creatures looking for a treat. He may also be in the company of someone dressed like a politician, a historical figure, or a cartoon character. Happy Halloween. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Why is Halloween such a popular holiday? How did it begin? On the program this afternoon, we'll look into the history and meaning of Halloween, from a Celtic festival to Christian Hallowtide to the holiday of today. It's a holiday that's just behind Christmas in terms of being a big treat for retailers. It's reported that billions of dollars worth of candy, decorations, costumes, and party goods are sold for Halloween annually. Our guest this afternoon is Nicholas Rogers. He is professor of history at York University and the author of the book Halloween, From Pagan Ritual to Party Night. The book is published by the Oxford University Press. In addition to Halloween, From Pagan Ritual to Party Night, Nicholas Rogers is the author of 18th Century English Society, Shuttles and Swords, and Crowds, Culture, and Politics in Georgian Britain. Listeners, I invite your questions for our guest, Nicholas Rogers. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Nicholas Rogers, thanks for talking with us this afternoon. I think we're in store for a treat.
I hope so. Very welcome.
You note in the book that Halloween has become a kind of continental Mardi Gras, and it's not just for children.
No, it's not just for children, and one of the points I want to make in the book is that it's never only been for children. Young adults in particular have always played an important role in Halloween since its beginnings, and certainly since it came over to North America. In many ways, the attempt to make it a children's night, or more almost exclusively, but certainly focusing on children, was a movement in the 1950s associated with trick-or-treating.
Mm-hmm. And that, to what extent was that an effort to tame Halloween?
Yeah, it was. It was an effort to tame it, to render it a little bit more infantile, more consumerist than it had been. The period between 1918, certainly, and 1939, 1940 was a period in which there were quite a lot of pranks played on Halloween, and the pranks they played were rather rougher than the ones that are normally seen today. Mm. So, and to the extent that the U.S. Senate even thought about trying to change the name of Halloween to Youth Honor Day and to get teenagers to pledge themselves to good behavior on that day. This movement didn't take off, but that gives you some sense of the alarm that was spreading around the potential mayhem associated with the holiday.
Yeah. A couple of things struck me as I read your book. One, how many incarnations Halloween has had.
Yeah.
And your observations about how it has always, to quote you, operated on the margins of mainstream commemorative practices.
Yeah.
Does that explain its longevity, that Halloween allows us to dance out onto the fringe a little?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. That was the point I wanted to make, that it is a bit of a holiday of transgression. It is a bit of a revel. It's a holiday when you can do things you don't normally do. You only do it for a framed amount of time, but it's a release in that respect. And it's one of, while there were other holidays in which one could do this in the early 19th century in North America, Halloween became the one that survived where you could really do this by the end of the century. The others became rather more domesticated events. Thanksgiving, for example, American Thanksgiving in New York, for example, there was quite a lot of festive begging and gallivanting around associated with it originally before it became much more of a family ritual. And the same went for Christmas until it became a lot more Dickensian, really. Christmas with a Christmas tree and exchange of presents with the family and the turkey dinner and so forth. But before that, it was a bit more open season and rather rougher hospitality all round. Now, though that disappeared, but Halloween stayed on the fringes.
Yeah. And even though, you know, myself, I have to confess I don't get into any mischief on Halloween, but it delights me to see the little trick-or-treaters, and it connects me with childhood and not having to be an adult for a night.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, sure, you can do that too, and the trick-or-treaters, it's fun. I mean, that side of it, I think, is fun. And they carry on that festive masking tradition that was very much part of early modern holidays and is now carried on to some degree by adults as well, actually, certainly in big cities.
The origins of Halloween go back to Europe, perhaps to an ancient Roman festival celebrating a goddess of fruits and seeds, or the old Celtic festival marking the end of summer, Samhain. Yeah. Has it always then been tied to harvest and the transition to winter?
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's one common theme to Halloween. It represents in many ways the winter's upon us. I mean, it's the end. Samhain, the Celtic festival to which you alluded, means summer's end. The Celts only had two seasons, really, summer and winter, and this was the border. This was the transition. And what we have to look forward to is winter from now on in. And in the Celtic scheme of things, but there was a certain degree of anxiety associated with that, particularly amongst communities that might not have had a lot of resources and wondered just who would survive, actually, the winter. So there has always been this sense of the harvest. And in some places in the United States, Halloween marks the beginning of the hunting season. In Vermont, I believe it does, for example. So a lot of the regalia we associate with the holiday is associated with the harvest and the fall. Pumpkins, apples, nuts in particular, have always been part of it. And the colors themselves in some ways.
Here again, I'm reminded of our efforts to tame Halloween, that in many schools now, it is promoted as a harvest festival, not as a time to be mischievous.
Yes, I think that we've got a debate going on about Halloween, and it's a debate that is really about whether the holiday has become too permissive, perhaps too pagan for some, too unsafe, whether in fact we need to reorient Halloween in some way and take out perhaps the ghoulishness associated with it. I think that that side of Halloween, the blood and gore, the kind of terror fest or the horror fest that is now part of the annual American Halloween, is troubling to a lot of people and has become perhaps a bit more troubling in the wake of 9/11, because after the terrorist attacks, people said, why on earth do we need this holiday? I mean, isn't this thoroughly inappropriate in the context? And people did then, in very energetic ways, try to actually tone down a little of the blood and gore last year and make it a different festival. And there are lots of people who would be interested in doing that. So in many ways, last year's discussion of how Halloween should be celebrated brought out its detractors and brought out those who would want a milder holiday. And I've noted a number of schools have stopped calling their fancy dress parades Halloween dress parades and have tried to change the tone of them.
I want to go back to Samhain in a minute here to talk more about the early history of this celebration. But I do want to talk with you a little bit about, this element of horror stories and haunted houses. How did these become part of the Halloween scene?
Well, Halloween's always had a connection with the supernatural. That's the first thing we should know. I mean, both in its Celtic early Celtic variant and in the Christian one. I mean, it was supposed to celebrate the souls in purgatory, the wandering souls who were neither in heaven nor hell and were kind of who could return. and in a period when religion and magic were closely intertwined, that was a real possibility. This was an age when people really did believe in both ghosts and people returning from the dead, whereas today that's not necessarily the case at all. What happened was also, I think, that in the 19th century, as part of the Romantic movement, Halloween became a little bit seen a little bit more gothic. It became, and the dead was treated rather as an aspect of the uncanny or the gothic, or and that's when witches started to appear in Halloween. There's a famous line from one of Sir Walter Scott's poems, actually. It says, "On All Hallows Eve, the night hag will ride," referring to the witch on the broomstick. And there is a sense in which it was made spooky and, I think, gradually became tied up with some of the classics in the Gothic genre, Frankenstein, Dracula. These are the stock figures now of a certain kind of Halloween. That was picked up on, picked up in the film, and picked up by radio, and picked up in popular culture. And then we get a very close association of Halloween and horror in the 1970s with the emergence of the stalker or slasher movies, of which the Halloween cycle is probably the one of the best known, as well as the Friday the 13th cycle Nightmare on Elm Street and so on. I mean, different kinds of horror movies, not about people from outer space or monsters from countries, but actually stalking killers within our own country. And that coincided, that 1970 promotion of that kind of horror, with a certain anxiety in North American cities about high crime rates, about children being left alone, about possible sexual abuse. And a lot of these fears, and at the time also stories of razors in apples and contaminated candies, and a lot of this seemed really spooky and genuinely so. And a lot of the fears focused on Halloween, so that stories about Halloween and commentaries on them became a kind of parable of urban anxiety.
It'll be interesting to see over the next little while here if we see some further changes in our attitudes toward Halloween, as you mentioned, September 11th of 2001. And now, once again, we're very frightened over disappearances of children, kidnappings.
Yes.
And the sniper attacks.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it may be that people, again, will want to move to a different style Halloween, which is not impossible. I mean, Halloween hasn't always been tied to horror. Sometimes it was rather more domestic event. Sometimes it was in the 19th century. I like to think of Halloween as a fairly mobile script. You can actually do quite a few things with it and pick up elements and rework them into different kinds of traditions. So I don't see anything particularly wrong in wanting to do that.
And it also is interesting to me that on the newsstand, for some weeks now, if not a couple of months already, I mean, Halloween is such a big thing. It seems it starts, somewhere in August.
Yes.
But on covers of magazines, like, for example, Better Homes and Gardens, Martha Stewart Living, that kind of thing, Halloween is a domestic, very tame kind of celebration where one bobs for apples and has a party, and the scariest thing that happens is there's a plastic spider on a cupcake.
I mean, some people, I mean, I think that the decorative side of that, and certainly in the supermarkets after the back to school promotions, you get the Halloween promotions, which are designed very much for that family centered market, and particularly a market for children under 10. There's a huge number of children's books on Halloween. I was actually quite astounded this year, the number I've seen in Toronto that are there, and telling tales and so forth. Very much the dressing up part for kids is still a very important aspect of the holiday. I was at a TV show this morning where there was some well-known children's songsters on, and they were singing away, and there were all these kids dressed in different costumes. And a lot of people like to think of Halloween as a very happy, rather innocent event. I mean, the problem they have with that is actually it's always had this darker side, which sometimes other entrepreneurs and other people in the entertainment industry are very keen to promote as well. So you get slightly schizoid views sometimes of Halloween and the way in which it should be promoted.
Yeah. Well, it's one of these holidays where whether we observe it, how we observe it, reflects very much who we are, where we live, and how we live.
Yes. Yes, I think that's true. Yeah, it is. And it's become, and that's part of its attractiveness, actually. I know there are people who get very upset because it's not, because, and they don't like perhaps the fact it's not, it doesn't have a steady script and a script that can be perhaps controlled. But in fact, I think part of the beauty of the holiday is precisely that. It's free form. You can make what you want of it, and it can. It can illustrate some of the nice things about our culture and some of the nastiest as well.
Mm. And I suppose that's why an attempt to make Halloween Youth Honor Day is just pretty much doomed.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, it's never going to happen. And particularly now that it's become captive in many ways to almost hardcore commercialism, really. I mean, it's a very big event. You know, $7 billion is spent on Halloween in the United States, and that's a huge amount of money relative to other holidays, save only Christmas, which absolutely dwarfs it in terms of expenditures, of course. But after Christmas, it is the second biggest retail event, and it's really an unofficial event. It's not recognized by the state or by the church as such, and it's really remarkable. It's actually, caught on.
It's not a holiday where the banks close for the day.
No. No, that's right. You can't, you know, you take a day off. You're taking a day off, your usual, you know, your vacation. You're not taking it, you know, it's not a day, it's not a bank holiday in any kind of way.
Is Halloween as big a holiday in Canada as it is here in the U.S.?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's a big holiday in Canada. Very big, and the same rituals here. There'll be trick-or-treating here tonight, and there'll probably be a few kids with UNICEF boxes and things like that. And we have a big downtown scene for the gay community, so there's a lot of drag parades down there, and there are lots of places in nightclubs and so forth that are putting on their costume parties And the schools are very active in promoting Halloween, too. I mean, in a way, actually, it's one of the big dress-up events of the fall term.
Hmm. Interesting. There's some marvelous pictures in the book, by the way, of costumed folks at a gay party.
Yeah.
Edward Scissorhands and down.
Yeah, that's right. So for a couple of years I went down actually to the area in Toronto on Church Street and with my camera and took some photos, and some of those were put into the book. Yeah. I had a lot of fun doing that, watching the kind of inventiveness of some of these ones. There is one in the book that is quite fun, I think, that listeners might be amused by, which was sort of a rendering of the Titanic, all these people dressed up in evening dress, and they are clutching large styrofoam boards, which are meant to represent ice, and every now and then, as they move down the street, they would all fall to the pavement as if they were sinking with the Titanic. It was actually very, very amusing to watch.
Very creative.
Yeah.
Great theater.
Yeah, great theater, yes.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking this afternoon about Halloween. Our guest is historian Nicholas Rogers. He's professor of history at York University and the author of Halloween, From Pagan Ritual to Party Night. The book is published by Oxford University Press. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome you, your questions, your comments. Join us with a telephone call. In the Champaign-Urbana area, the telephone number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In the book, there's a lot of really interesting information about the history of Halloween. And we talked a little bit earlier, a little bit about Samhain, this Celtic end of summer celebration festival. What might have happened during Samhain?
What might have happened during Samhain? It's a tricky question, actually. I want to just preface it by saying that, because we don't know much about this holiday. What we've got are Celtic myths, in which we can make some inferences about it, and then what we've got is Roman reflections on what the Druids were like, and they didn't like the Druids very much, so they said some nasty things about them. What I think is most important about Samhain is that it's a holiday for taking stock. It was a period in pastoral communities, in particular, when you'd bring all the cattle in, you'd stockade them, you might kill some, and salt the meat. In many ways, be rather anxious about whether you've got enough supplies to survive the winter, and you might well, in some ways, pray to the gods that for a mild winter. Now, whether that praying involved human sacrifice or whether it involved animal sacrifice is a very controversial issue. If you believe what the Romans said about the Druids, although they didn't say it necessarily happened on Samhain, but if you infer that, you know, the Druids must have officiated at this holiday, then there would have been human sacrifices and some blood spilt of humans. And this is not inconceivable, but it's guesswork, basically. And we know that probably it was also a time of fortune-telling. It was certainly a time when people tried to understand the seasonal dormancy, the withering of the crops, and there's some interesting myths about that. And there's also some stories told about regeneration, about the gods looking forward to a regenerative year. I mean, the spring that will eventually come out of the winter. So there's that too. The pagan side has been controversial because, of course, those that want to emphasize the nasty aspects of Halloween, and they're usually opponents of it, will want to highlight what they see as the sanguinary, the bloody rites of Samhain. And certainly some of the Halloween movies themselves have tried to play on that. But the truth is, the Romans were writing third and fourth hand, and they were writing in a propagandist kind of way, and so it's tricky evidence.
So it might have been Roman spin.
Yes, absolutely. It might have been Roman spin. And the Celtic myths themselves don't make much reference to sacrifices at all, which is a kind of unusual disparity between the two principal sources. They only in one instance do they talk about one of the Irish nations, the Formorians, actually exacting a tribute of firstborn children from one of the other Celtic nations, and so and that could be construed as a sacrificial rite as well. But apart from that, they don't say very much about sacrifices. And again, with these sagas, these were written down. They were part of really of an oral tradition and not written down for 400 or 500 years. So again, you don't know how much embellishment there had been in the process and what had been taken out. So it's once you get into this, this wasn't exactly my field of expertise when I wrote this book, and I had to sort of get in. I sort of parachuted into it. I tried to tread warily, actually, through it, because I thought, gosh, you know, there's an awful lot that is often attributed to Halloween, which is based on pretty dubious evidence and depends a lot on how you work it through.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we think about the party game telephone, and then to have sort of a telephone through the centuries, a telephone game through the centuries, it must be very difficult for historians and for folklorists to sort of sort out what made a good story from what actually might have been happening.
Yes, Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, now with the arrival of Christianity,
yeah,
what happened to Samhain and these autumnal harvest festivals that might or might not have involved animal and human sacrifice?
Well, what happens is that they get, to some degree, incorporated into All Saints and All Souls, and in Gaelic areas, I think, Gaelic-speaking areas in particular, the pagan rituals and meanings associated with it, with the holiday, persist. In many respects, you could say that All Saints and All Souls, which prays for wandering souls in purgatory, for people who might return from the dead, has obvious supernatural connotations and would fit quite neatly with some of the beliefs of Samhain, in which fairies and spirits were abroad, so that it wouldn't be very difficult to move from one to the other, and there must be a good deal of sort of syncretism between the two about the supernatural side of the holiday. And what you get with All Souls is some of that supernaturalness coming out. You know, if you saw actually people you knew to be dead or specters of the dead in the churchyard, you knew there was going to be a death in your family. And there are all sorts of stories and superstitions surrounding the holiday. It was a holiday in which you could foretell the future. In some contexts, foretelling who your future spouse might be, but in other contexts, foretelling whether there would be a death in your family as well. And some of the rites associated with Samhain were tried to be contained by the church. They didn't like some of the fire rites, which were considered of pagan and superstitious, and there were attempts to do that. These fire rites were associated either with warding off spirits or with actually blessing fields. Sometimes there would be torch-like processions through fields in the hope that the fields would remain fertile once they were re-sown in the spring. So you get these kinds of things. What we get out of the Christian festivals of All Saints and All Souls, I think in particular, what's important to the subsequent development of Halloween are a set of festive conventions. And as the holiday becomes more secular and as one no longer thinks quite the same about souls in purgatory, these festive conventions persist. One of them was door-to-door collections to pray for souls in purgatory. So that's where people often carrying candles in hollowed-out turnips. This is clearly a referent in part or can be traced forward to the jack-o'-lantern and can be traced to the threshold encounters we see in trick-or-treating. All Saints and All Souls was also a period of masking and merriment, and like many other early modern festivals, it was also a time of informal community policing in an age when there were no police forces and in which you got young men in the neighborhood to do it for you. And so, in fact, All Saints and All Souls might be a time when there would be elements of community retribution against people who were thought to break community standards in some kinds of ways, and clearly that has some resonances to pranking in North America, even though pranking sometimes quite aimless. Sometimes it's actually the worst pranks are inflicted upon people who are seen as skinflints, perhaps, or something.
Mm.
So these festive conventions persist in some ways, although their meaning, they get emptied of their early modern meaning and new meanings get put into them.
Yeah. But it's very interesting to me that if we go back some way, that, you know, here we have All Hallows Eve, the day before All Saints Day, 2 days before All Souls Day, and we have a fitting together of Celtic beliefs, the festival of Samhain, where people are, as you mentioned earlier, maybe putting things to bed for a season.
Yeah.
Until spring, we have in the natural world and in the supernatural world, we have death and rebirth.
Yes.
And afterlife.
Yes. Yes.
So it fits together.
Yeah, they fit together, and obviously we've played out those themes in different kinds of ways over time. Mm. Yeah.
But today many critics of Halloween will charge it is satanic, but it would seem to me that clearly its roots are not.
No, its roots aren't satanic. In fact, I don't like this idea. You could say its roots are pagan, but they're not satanic, and because actually Satan or Lucifer is really a creation of Christian belief, and it belongs to a certain belief in the dualism between good and evil that is fought out in a Christian context. And so it's not really related to pagan belief. Pagans had many gods closely associated with nature and fertility. And in a sort of polytheistic context, you don't have Satan. So I think that's a very misleading kind of construction that some people want to make. But certainly they're obviously troubled by the kind of emphasis on the uncanny, the macabre, on what they would see as signs and signifiers that are anti-Christian in some kind of way. I think those are the people that get very upset with sometimes the way Halloween is celebrated today, and it's a bit of a battleground, and it's become a more explicitly open battleground, I think, in the last 10 to 15 years.
Hmm. All Saints' Day is a day of obligation for Roman Catholics. When did that happen?
When does that happen?
Yeah.
It's on the 1st of November, and All Souls is on the 2nd.
Right, but I mean, in terms of church history, when did that become day of obligation?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. It was initially All Saints was celebrated around Easter time. Initially, it was actually a celebration for the Christian martyrs, those martyred by the Romans. Then it became one associated with the saints. And then around 800 A.D., it moved to the 1st of November.
Mm.
It was then joined by All Souls, which was in some ways a kind of monastic invention, really. It comes from the Cluniac order of monks, and the two together were celebrated as a sort of a high Christian holiday by the end of the 12th century, with requiem masses and bells, praying for souls in purgatory, and so on.
Was that in any sense at all a reaction to Halloween?
Well, in Ireland, I don't think so, because initially All Saints in Ireland was celebrated on the 20th of April. One would have thought that if it had been an attempt to sort of Christianize a pagan belief, they'd have moved it to the 1st of November immediately, but it took several hundred years for that to actually happen. So you've got a bit of a problem with the days on which it's celebrated if you want to make that kind of case, I think. I don't want to see. I like to see it as a mix of the two traditions, rather than the superimposition of Christian upon a bedrock of pagan belief, in which the Christian side of things is really rather superficial. I don't think that's really the case, but there's some room for interpretation on this. I'm not saying I've got the last word on it, and there are other people who will want to emphasize that.
Yeah. I think that there's an anecdote in the book that you share with readers that on All Saints Day or All Hallows Eve, that in Ireland, that a priest tells his those with him in church for Mass that, you know, on your way home now, go slow. You know, let the spirits have enough time to get out of the way.
Yeah, yeah, and that sort of really shows the kind of how actually Christian belief and pagan belief could often be
hand in
used
hand
together,
yeah.
A certain kind of way, and certainly there was a. It wasn't impossible to believe in fairies and to believe in the supernatural and to be a good Catholic in Ireland. I mean, that was certainly the case, you know, for many, many centuries. And so the interesting thing about the Irish celebrations, and the Irish have celebrated Halloween for a long time, is that it gets called different things in different parts of the country, sometimes by rather secular names and sometimes by Samhain and sometimes by Halloween or some variant of, thereof of Halloween. So it's interesting that it has this diversity of names in many ways, which and probably reflects certain regional traditions within Ireland. I mean, I think one of the things I think that is interesting about Halloween, and actually one that I don't touch on a lot because I'm really interested in broad strokes and broad sweeps through time, but one of the interesting things is that regional celebrations of Halloween can vary and even do vary today, and what you choose to emphasize as well as individual ones. So certain parts of the country, for example, have different kinds of traditions. To give you just one example, Ohio has a beggar's night before Halloween, and it used to be customary and still is in parts of Ohio to go trick-or-treating the night before Halloween, not actually on Halloween. I've been told that whereas Beggar's Night was the night for the trick-or-treating, Halloween was the night for the pranks, whereas you don't get that necessarily in other parts of the country. So there is a sense in which sometimes, you know, some of these regional practices come into play in the holiday, and they are really quite important and mean that, but they're sometimes difficult to track down.
Mm. And then, you know, it's interesting to me as well as that, you know, Irish and Scottish people observed Halloween. But then in England, Australia, and New Zealand, we have Mischief Night, the eve of Guy Fawkes Day. Correct?
Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, I was really struck by this. I was really wondering why on earth the Australians didn't celebrate Halloween, because they had a lot of Irish immigrants as well as English, and you would have thought the holiday would have taken on. And the reason is seasonal dissonance, actually. I mean, that's the real reason that, you know, the 31st of October, it's hot. You're on the beach in Australia. This is the season for, you're into summer, or you're soon going into summer. You're not going into winter. So the whole seasonal aspect of the holiday just doesn't make any sense. And I think that was perhaps one of the reasons why, in fact, it didn't take. It didn't take in quite the way it did in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah, you're not about to embark on harvest.
Yeah.
In Australia and New Zealand on November 4th.
Yeah.
We're talking this afternoon about Halloween. I'm surprised we haven't heard from any listeners this afternoon. I'm shocked, actually. Historian Nicholas Rogers is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Halloween from Pagan Ritual to Party Night. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the afternoon magazine today. If you'd like to join us, if you've got a question about Halloween, now's the time. 333-9455, the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. How did customs change with the move across the Atlantic when the Irish and Scottish immigrated to the U.S. and Canada?
I think Initially, I don't think they changed a great deal. I mean, I think the holiday came over and it was a holiday for divinations or pranks and games within inside and perhaps with some pranking outside. I think what happened to the pranking, though, was that it no longer had quite the community context, the same community context, whereas pranking in small Irish or Scottish communities had a lot to do with neighborly behavior, I think, actually, in big city America, where it's easier to pick up in the 19th century than it is anywhere else. It clearly was a holiday in which there was just pranking on the streets was a sort of just an example of youthful revelry in many ways. The interesting thing about it coming over is it was never a sectarian holiday. It was, you know, it was a Celtic holiday, Irish and Scottish, but you didn't get any of the battles between Catholics and Protestants over this holiday that you did over some other Irish holidays. And what happens to it, so it becomes that, I think it becomes more secular. It quickly becomes actually more commercial. There are signs of it getting more commercial in the 1870s, and it gets picked up by other people other than the Scots and the Irish quite quickly, I think, within at least a generation after the Irish potato famine and the big movement of Irish people across to North America, the holidays being celebrated by a wide variety of people. Some of whom would be able to recognize the holiday or recognize some of the traditions. There is a tradition of Martinmas a little bit later in the German repertoire, in which children go and sing songs and carry lanterns, which wouldn't be so unlike some of the rituals of Halloween. So I mean, yeah. I think it was easier for some groups to pick it up, but it's remarkable how within 50 or so years it starts to broaden its constituency and
catches
become
fire.
The kind of continental holiday it now is.
Yeah. Well, now we have several phone calls, several people waiting to talk with us on the telephone. So let's go and see if we can get a couple of these callers in on the discussion this afternoon. First, we're going to go to a caller on line one in Hammond. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, this is really interesting to me as far as where the holidays come from and so on. And of course, All Saints Day, it was named by the Catholic Catholicism, just like Christmas and so on, Mary, Christ, Mass, and all these things which stem back to pagan religions and so on that had incorporated this into the Catholic Church. And of course, they gave it a Christianized name. And I guess that's about all I had to say, but I always thought that these were... It is very interesting to see the history of them.
Okay, well, thanks for the call. Let's go and talk with another listener before our time is up this afternoon. Next, we go to a caller in Terre Haute on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Yes, I just wanted to say that I really appreciate you being on the show today. I've always been fascinated with Halloween, and, of course, I'm very interested in its history. I also wanted to say that wanted to know if your book covers anything about modern Wiccanism and their beliefs in the holiday, or possibly even the Gothic subculture.
Okay, good question.
I deal with the Wiccans very marginally. Actually, I do talk a little bit about them, and it's clear that the Wiccans have tried to, from what I've read of Wiccan worship, that they've tried to recover some of the pagan spiritual side of the holiday, make it a more peaceful holiday, and interestingly, actually make it a holiday for possibly commemorating the dead, as well as the change in the seasons and the spiritual side of that. And I found that actually quite fascinating. I don't go into it in a great deal of detail, in fact, only really in the context of what I see as Halloween being a contested holiday and a holiday that is celebrated by a whole range of different groups in the late 20th and early 21st century.
Mm. And let's squeeze in our last caller this afternoon. Line 2, a caller in Danville, but we'll have to be brief. Go ahead.
Hello, thank you. I just wanted to call in and say the same thing the other two did. This is quite fascinating. You've been asking good questions, too. You know, so that's why we hadn't called in. You were doing it all for us. You know, you always have good guests, and I just want to say thank you again.
Well, bye. Thanks for the call this afternoon. And our thanks this afternoon to you, Professor Rogers. Thanks so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Nicholas Rogers has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Halloween, From Pagan Ritual to Party Night. The book is published by the Oxford University Press.